Nonetheless, a review of the broad literature on this topic concluded that the implant provides only coarse and degraded versions of sound, and therefore children with the implant receive fewer fine distinctions of spoken language than their hearing peers. This means that some implanted children, not exposed to sign because they are expected to develop speech, may fall into that frightening category of the needlessly impaired who have meager primary language. Cochlear Limited has shown that implanted children learn more and better oral language. But more and better is a little vague if this is to be your sole mode of communication. Parents too often want to believe that the implants make their children hearing and do not secure any special deaf education for them. You should bring up these children bilingually until it becomes clear that the child can develop satisfactory oral language. Robert Rubin, former chairman of the Unified Department of Otolaryngology at Montefiore Medical Center, advised, "Language of any kind, no matter what kind, must somehow be got into the head of the child soon enough." The implant destroys all residual hearing. Although accurate hearing tests can be performed on very young children, it is not possible to determine how well those children might be able to use their residual hearing. Anyone with a hearing loss over 90 decibels is classified as profoundly deaf. Yet I have met profoundly deaf people who are able to make such good use of their residual hearing that I could talk to them almost as I would to a hearing person. Hearing loss is measured as an average of loss in various registers. Most sounds operate at many frequencies, so someone with 100 decibel hearing loss could still be able to perceive high-frequency sounds. Even Tom Waits and James Earl Jones produce some high-frequency sound waves when they speak. Further, detection of sound and discrimination of sound are two separate abilities. Some people are able to use intuitive abilities, high-frequency functions, and other natural gifts to discriminate sound well beyond their ability to detect it. The NAD's original response to the implants condemned invasive surgery on defenseless children when the long-term physical, emotional, and social effects on children from this irreversible procedure, which will alter the lives of those children, have not been scientifically established. As the devices evolved and came into wider use, the NAD moderated its position somewhat, saying, "The surgery decision represents the beginning of a process that involves a long-term and likely lifelong commitment to auditory training, rehabilitation, acquisition of spoken and visual language skills, follow-up, and possibly additional surgeries," and cochlear implantation is not a cure for deafness. If you are not in a village in northern Bali where everyone knows sign, and you opt against the implants for your child, you will find yourself trying to learn a new language at the same time your child is learning it. And children can learn language better than adults can. To choose sign for your deaf child is, in some significant ways, to surrender him or her to deaf culture. It is not so easy to give up your own children, and it does not always work out so well for parent or child. Christina Palmer said, "It's the deaf ethnicity hypothesis. If you come from a hearing family, you don't get the cultural aspect unless you somehow connect with other deaf people and learn about a deaf community." Whereas oral communication places strain upon the deaf member of the family, the decision to sign shifts the power base, placing the greater strain of understanding upon the hearing members. In effect, parents can learn sign and always speak awkwardly to their child, or they can push their child toward oralism and know that he will always speak awkwardly to them. It is a familiar adage of parenthood that the parent should sacrifice for the child, rather than the other way around. But to anoint sign as the righteous choice is to prioritize a specific vision of how the margins understand the mainstream, and vice versa. Nancy and Dan Hesse have fallen passionately on both sides of this debate since their daughter Emma became deaf, and their quest has been as much spiritual as medical. They had both converted to Buddhism in adulthood and met at a Buddhist center in Boulder, Colorado. Nancy had a hysterectomy a few years later and became terribly depressed. When a colleague announced that she and her husband had decided to adopt a baby from Asia, Nancy became determined to do the same thing. Dan was determined that they should not, he laughingly recalled, because it might get out of control, come to dominate your life. But Nancy ultimately prevailed. On June 29, 1998, Dan and Nancy arrived in Hanoi and headed almost immediately for the orphanage. It couldn't have been more alienating, Dan said. Third world brutalist architecture, big picture of Ho Chi Minh. The deputy head of the orphanage explained that the baby they were to receive had had pneumonia, had lost a quarter of her weight, and had to stay at the orphanage until she finished her course of antibiotics. Nancy asked to meet her. They put her in my arms, and she looked right in my eyes and smiled, Nancy said. But the smiling baby looked incredibly drawn, and the daughter of the head of the orphanage suddenly said, I think you should take her to the International Hospital, right now. At the International Hospital, somebody took a chest X-ray, said that the baby's pneumonia was clearing up, and provided a prescription for cephalosporin. When the baby's face flushed, Nancy realized she was having an allergic reaction. Soon, she was throwing up blood and had bloody diarrhea. For the next 10 days, Dan and Nancy lived in the hospital. Eventually, they moved back to the hotel. U.S. adoptions of Vietnamese babies had to be processed through Bangkok, so Dan went to Thailand. Nancy took the baby to the hospital daily for nebulizing. Sitting in the waiting room, Nancy saw a card from an Israeli doctor, which said that his clinic serviced the U.S. Embassy. Nancy brought him all the medical records, and he did blood work and explained that the baby had both cytomegalovirus and HIV. He assured Nancy that people would take care of the baby until she died, and that they would get another kid they'd be happy with. Dan was furious. What were we going to do? Throw her back like a fish that wasn't worth the trouble to clean and eat, he said to me. But American law prohibited the immigration of HIV-positive children. Fortuitously, the Hesses had once taken in a member of the local Buddhist community who was dying of AIDS, so Dan knew people at the Boulder County AIDS Project who could help them. Meanwhile, Nancy waited and waited for the Vietnamese government to approve the adoption. After 2 fraught months, both sides came through, and the family all flew home together. The baby, whom they had named Emma, was admitted on arrival in the United States for a clinical evaluation at Children's Hospital Colorado in Denver. 4 days later, a doctor called with the news. Emma was not HIV positive. The ripples of joy spread everywhere, Nancy said. 2 weeks later, Emma couldn't hear anything except a loud bang. She had most likely been exposed to cytomegalovirus in utero, which had caused her hearing to degenerate until it was almost entirely gone. A deaf member of the Hesse's community told them how much better life was for deaf children of deaf parents. Nancy and Dan decided to be like those deaf parents. Dan had read the deaf invectives against cochlear implants, and he and Nancy decided to respect Emma for who she was rather than to fix her. But there were no deaf schools in Boulder. Their audiologist told them that they should move to Boston, San Francisco, or Austin, where deaf education was strong. So when Emma was 14 months old, they relocated to Austin and enrolled Emma in early learning programs at the Texas School for the Deaf. Emma had started walking, but she stopped. Her motor focus was entirely on signing. Dan and Nancy began lessons in ASL, but neither showed much of a gift for it. Dan said, "You'd hear these stories like, 'This deaf person's parents never learned to sign. How could they have ever done that? I couldn't learn to sign to save my goddamn life.'" Nancy said, "But then we visited the public school oral program, and we met kids who were not allowed to sign, and it was horrific. It was very clear to both of us that it was definitely child abuse to try to make a deaf kid oral." In Texas, Emma developed severe asthma, and the family found themselves in the emergency room weekly. Dan and Nancy had trouble finding work, and the marriage fell apart. Dan said, "Nancy's attention was completely on Emma's survival, which was a genuine issue at that point. But I no longer felt like she could collaborate with me. I had been demoted to being a helper in the background." When Dan announced that he had to return to Colorado, Nancy refused to go with him. But neither did she want to live and die in Texas. She had checked out the Learning Center for the Deaf in Framingham, Massachusetts, and hit it off with the head of the school, who offered her a job. Dan, who didn't want to be half the country away from his daughter, moved to nearby Vermont. Nancy started working full-time at the school and wanted Dan to take Emma on a schedule. Dan was resentful and also scared of looking after Emma alone. Compassion is the ability to care unconditionally for another person, not based on fulfilling your expectations, Dan said. I was good on the theory, and then the bar got raised way high, and it was very humbling. Meanwhile, neither of them was good at sign. I was failing miserably at ASL, and it was my job too, Nancy said. She began talking to Dan about cochlear implants. They had both been hailed as heroes by their deaf friends for moving around the country to ensure their child an optimal sign education. And now they were getting ready, as they saw it, to betray deaf values. When Emma was 4, she had one ear implanted in a 7-hour procedure. Nancy took her to post-surgical follow-up and was told that the wound was severely infected and that her daughter might die. Emma was put on IV antibiotics. Her asthma had been linked to allergies to dairy, soy, wheat, and several other foods, and she had been managing well on a restricted diet and inhaled steroids. After the surgery, she became asthmatic again, and nothing seemed to help. Nancy quit her job. Though they were divorcing, Dan and Nancy both decided to move back to Boulder. "It's kind of a circle," Nancy said. "She came to Boulder with hearing, she left when she was deaf, she came back when she was starting to hear again." Meanwhile, Emma was caught between two cultures and two languages, exactly where her parents had hoped she would never be. She went to cochlear implant camp 4 days a week that summer for audiological training. At Dan's insistence and despite Nancy's bad memories of the first implant surgery, Emma was implanted in her other ear. This time, it all went smoothly. By the time I met Emma, she was 9. Her grammar and usage were not quite at age level, but she was speaking fluidly and unselfconsciously. Nancy said, "She's done better than any of the professionals we've worked with have ever seen. They think it's because she was fluent in a language, ASL, before this." With the second implant, Emma shot up from a 25% success rate on open sound recognition to 75%. Dan and Nancy had sworn to keep Emma in a bicultural environment, but that became increasingly difficult. They noticed that when she could sign or speak, she always spoke. Gradually, when Emma was 7 or so, they allowed her signing to stop, and they settled into a largely amicable co-parenting arrangement. Emma said to me, "We had a hard trip to go home, but we made it because we're all strong and gentle." Dan said, "When you have a disabled child, you say either, 'I've got this new asset in my life who is going to make me happy and proud,' or, 'I'm enslaved by my child who is going to be full of needs until I get so old and exhausted that I fall over dead.' The truth about this situation always involves both. Buddhism is about nothing else than these dualities. But did that make it easy? No. I had to relearn my Buddhist practice from the point of view of playing for real. I lost my hobby." Most medical insurance will now cover the implant, the surgery, and the recommended audiological training. The cost can run well over $60,000, but the surgery is still an economically good choice for insurers. Industry-funded studies at Johns Hopkins and the University of California at San Diego have shown that implantation saves an average of $53,000 per child over the cost of other accommodations to deafness. But the calculus here is complex. Many people who have trouble adjusting to implants run up bills. Deaf people who develop good sign early are not as expensive as those who need accommodation for traumatic childhoods. For most hearing parents, the choice seems straightforward. One mother said, "If your child needs glasses, you get glasses. If your child needs a leg, you get a prosthetic. It's the same thing." Another said, "If at 20, Dorothy Jane wants to turn off her voice, that's fine. I want her to have a choice." Those with the implants who are reclassed as hearing do not receive the accommodations they would get as disabled people. The problem is that those who do not get implants may be seen as having chosen their condition in the face of a cure, at which point they do not deserve the charity of taxpayers. The existence of the implants may, therefore, take disability status from other deaf people. Rory Osbrink was born hearing, an eager and athletic child. One December Friday in 1981, soon after his third birthday, Rory came down with what appeared to be the flu. His parents, Bob and Mary, packed him off to bed, gave him liquids, and kept a close eye on him. He was no better by Saturday, and on Sunday he suddenly seemed to be much worse, so they brought him to the emergency room. Bob and Mary sat waiting while the doctors ran some tests. Eventually one came out and announced, "We think he'll make it." Stunned, Bob replied, "He's got the flu, right?" They said, "He has rapidly advancing meningitis, and he's gone into a coma." Rory was in an oxygen tent for the next 5 days. He was in and out of the hospital for 40 days. He was getting repeated spinal taps, and they couldn't give him anesthetic because it would mask the white cell count, Bob recalled. "I was the only one that could hold him while he's screaming through those spinal taps. I still go into shock if I hear a 3-year-old cry." Bob Osbrink was a professional musician, and it had long been his habit to play his guitar and sing to Rory in the evenings. In the hospital, Rory stopped responding to Bob's singing. In an effort to control the Osbrink's trauma, everyone at the hospital said that Rory's hearing would come back, though the medical staff knew his deafness was permanent. "False hope is brutal," Bob said. They brought Rory home in time for New Year's, and when fireworks went off, they ran up to comfort him, but he slept right through them. When he was well enough to stand, he fell, because meningitis often affects the inner ear as well as the cochlea. He had no sense of balance. Bob Osbrink has been haunted by guilt ever since. "What if I had gotten him in sooner?" he asked. "The experts told me we probably would have diagnosed the flu and said he didn't belong in the hospital." Bob and Mary had very different reactions to the experience. Bob became almost manically active, trying to keep Rory engaged, while Mary became quietly protective of her son. One time she said, "Does this not bother you at all?" Bob remembered. "I got mad, and I said, 'Of course it bothers me. It's tearing me apart inside. You sit and cry. I can't just sit and not do something.'" Bob gave up music. He didn't even listen to the radio for a year. Neither Bob nor Mary knew what to do with the deaf child. "He wasn't a real verbal little guy in the first place," Bob said. "His older brother spoke very articulately, specifically, eloquently. He had good speech before he was 3. Rory was not as advanced." Bob's parents had an acquaintance who knew Dr. Howard House, founder of the House Ear Institute, and Dr. House told Bob about a brand new technology, the cochlear implant, which had not yet been approved for children. "We met deaf adults who had had an implant and saw that they could hear sounds. We reviewed studies on the one little girl who had been implanted and saw her reacting to her parents' voices. Rory had already been through so much hospital time. Were we going to put him through more?" Bob was aware that the FDA had not approved the device for children because of concerns about how a developing brain would respond to a foreign object inserted in it. The device was still single channel, and none of the adults who'd received it had become fully verbal. Then Rory walked into the street and was nearly hit by a fire truck that was speeding past with sirens blaring. At 4, Rory became the second child ever to receive an implant. "We thought awareness of sound would improve Rory's safety and would help his lip reading. It was a very emotional day when Rory sat in the testing booth and reacted to a sound. But the sound Rory got was extremely primitive and ultimately not very useful. His inner ear damage meant he was still unsteady on his feet. Bob wanted to recapture Rory's athletic promise, a long-term negotiation. Rory was enrolled at mainstream schools and played on the school teams. Bob coached Rory's little league team and gave him extra practice mornings and afternoons. By the time he was 8, Rory was a star player, had begun to sign, and had joined a deaf team. Bob coached that team as well. Rory would read his lips and then interpret to the players. "You can have an international soccer team where everybody on the field is speaking a different language, and yet they will play the game the same," Bob said. "The game itself allows you to connect. It has its own language." It meant he was that great ball player, not that deaf guy. Bob shares music with his older son. Sports was his bond with Rory. Bob was interested in sign, but he didn't study it, and Rory asked him to continue to speak to him. He even asked him to keep his mustache. "You talk to me more than anybody, Dad, with the coaching. If I can lip-read you, that keeps me sharp." But later, Bob realized that this was all part of the frequent deaf habit of seeming to get more than you do. "I didn't realize until later how much he was missing all the time," Bob said. "I knew how smart he was, and he was not making it in algebra. I said, 'Let me sit in the class.'" The teacher was writing formulas on the board and speaking with his back to the room. In junior high, Rory began working seriously on ASL, and in high school he learned about deaf identity. He got a baseball scholarship to the University of Arizona and went to meet the coach. "I called him on the phone over and over again, telling him about Rory's situation," Bob said. "Rory's a great lip reader. You just need to look him straight in the eye." So the coach comes in and he's looking down and Rory says, "Coach, if you look up, I can really read lips well. Speak a little slower and I'm going to get it." The coach pulls out a pad, drops it on his desk, and starts writing out notes with an attitude. Rory wadded up the paper, said, "I can't play for you. drove out that night, and went to Gallaudet. Rory never really came back to the hearing world. At Gallaudet, he majored in deaf studies and philosophy, with the resident assistant in his dorm, and played on the baseball team. When Rory graduated, the Dodgers offered him a tryout. He got in touch with Curtis Pride, who played pro baseball and is hard of hearing, and who said that no one in the pro sports world was going to help the deaf guy. Rory turned down the Dodgers' offer and got a master's in education instead. It all goes back to that experience in Arizona, Bob said. Every now and then, we'll go to a baseball game and watch a guy playing. He'll go, "Hey, Dad, I was as good as that guy, huh?" And I'll go, "Yeah, you sure were." Rory later married a woman who was fifth-generation deaf. He turned off his implant and has never used it again. He said that with it, he felt like a duck in a world of chickens. The deaf world became his home. Rory now teaches deaf children in the fifth and sixth grades. He gave up baseball, but he coaches a deaf team that has made it to championship level, and he's become a fanatic bicyclist. He has rewritten the course curriculum for California deaf education. He's told me that he remembers a little bit about sound, Bob said, but it's not a real vivid memory. Rory has militated against parents implanting their young children. As for pediatric cochlear implant, it should not be tolerated since it ignores the child's right to choice, he wrote. Bob said of his own decision, "I did what I thought was right. It was not some big philosophical discussion between deaf and hearing, because I had no clue about that." Rory understands why his parents made their decision, and Bob understands why his son reversed it. "I realize that when he was in an oral environment, he was getting about 90%, Bob said. "That sounds like a lot. But if you really care about people, and he's a very empathetic guy, then you want to get everything. I totally accept and respect who he is and what he wants. I used to tell people, I've got one son who is deaf, and I've got three who won't listen to me. Selfishly, I'd love for him to be able to sing and play the guitar with me, and he'd like for me to be fluent in signing." I wondered whether the child must always win in these debates, whether there is some writ in which a parent's job is rising to the occasion, while a child's job is simply being. Bob Osbrink seemed both prouder and more melancholic than many other people I had interviewed. Rory was deafened at 3, and 3 years is a long time in a parent's life and in a child's. I wondered whether Bob's wistfulness perhaps stemmed from having lost a deep connection with his son, not once, but twice. First music, and then sports. "The things that hurt me are things I missed, like my not knowing when he acted like he got it when he wasn't getting it," Bob said. "Laughing when everybody laughed, but not knowing what the joke was. I'm sad that he had to go through everything he's had to go through. A part of me will always be sad, but I don't think he's sad, and I'm certainly not sad about who he is." The bioethicist Teresa Blankmeyer Burke said, "It is rare that one grieves for something that one has not lost. Consider gender as an analogy. A woman might wonder what it would be like to be a man, or vice versa. Yet this curiosity is not likely to be expressed in terms of loss." Paula Garfield, artistic director of the London-based Definitely Theatre Company, and her partner, Tomato Leachy, were thrilled when they found out their daughter was deaf, because it gave her a passport to inclusion in a rich and varied culture. "The general culture feels that deaf children are primarily children who lack something. They lack hearing. the deaf culture feels that they have something. They have membership in a beautiful culture. Hearing parents are thrown back on their own dichotomy. Do they have a deaf child, or do they lack a hearing one? Like Bob Osbrink, Felix Feldman thought that the ability to function in the oral world was valuable, that acculturation was the natural and only goal. When he had a daughter who was deaf, there was no such thing as an implant. When he had grandchildren who were deaf, the implant was advanced and the kids were not interested. Felix has an old-style Jewishness that habitually seeks the cloud accompanying any silver lining. In his view, and despite his love for his progeny, little recommends the experience of having two deaf children, and the arrival of three deaf grandchildren has been no further blessing. Felix and Rachel Feldman's younger daughter, Esther, was born with cerebral palsy. With a hearing aid, her sound discrimination was sufficient for language development. Just as the family was struggling with her diagnosis, the pediatrician told them that their older daughter, Miriam, was deaf. It was 1961, and Felix and Rachel opted for an oral education for Miriam, same as Esther. The orthodoxy was still that children learning orally should have no exposure to sign, so it was forbidden in their house. "We would break Miriam's arms if she signed," Felix said. Felix and Rachel went to class themselves to learn how to reinforce the oral lessons at home. Having heard of a good speech therapist in Santa Monica, they moved there. Their lives were focused around deafness. "We had contact with deaf people, but all speaking people," Felix said. Though Esther now functions relatively well for a person with CP, the path was long and difficult. Miriam, though much more deaf, was a model child. She had speech therapy every day at school and private tutoring 3 days a week. Her passion was competitive figure skating. The coach was allowed to give her 3 signs, one to say when the music started, one at the halfway point to tell her to speed up or slow down, and one at the end to tell her the music was finished. "Competing to music without hearing one note," her father said. At school, she was always at the top of the class, with all the hearing children, completely from lip-reading the teacher. She never saw herself as handicapped. When Miriam was 15, she competed in the 1975 World Winter Games for the Deaf in Lake Placid, New York, and was immersed for the first time in a context where the primary language was sign. "She picked it up very fast," Felix recalled. "There was nothing we could do." Miriam said to me, "It was hard learning sign. It took many years because I came to it so late and with so many anxieties. My mom and dad always saying, 'Don't sign, don't sign.' At the Deaf Olympics, everyone else was signing, and I didn't know how. It was humiliating." Felix felt betrayed by Miriam signing, though he admits that her verbal skills have remained strong. Miriam started and runs the Jewish Deaf Community Center in her California town. She issues publications, organizes social events around Jewish holidays, and is a leader within her community. She conducts about 80% of her communication in sign and about 20% in speech. "But all my language would be better if I'd been allowed to sign as a child," she said. When cochlear implants became viable, Felix tried to get Miriam, then in her 20s, to have one. But she was enamored of the deaf culture, and the idea was repugnant to her. "We discussed, we fought, we screamed," Felix said. "I lost. We know younger and older people who have had it. They hear you. They use the telephone. They listen to the news. They watch TV. Why wouldn't you have it?" Unfortunately, she and her ex-husband feel that it's genocide. All three of Miriam's children, ages 17, 15, and 13 when we met, are deaf. Felix pushed for them to receive oral coaching. But it is hard for parents who cannot hear to support oral instruction in the intensive way it requires. Miriam took the line of least resistance, Felix said. If they didn't sign, they would speak. It's heartbreaking. Though Felix can communicate easily with Miriam, he is unable to have a conversation with his grandchildren. Miriam's eldest is now enrolled at the world's only Orthodox deaf yeshiva and is learning Hebrew and Yiddish. Miriam said, I had to follow people's lips all day long. I didn't want my kids to go through that. My kids are happy. They know how to spell, and they were signing at 8 months old. They were able to tell me how they felt and what they wanted. I wondered whether they had hearing friends at school. When my daughter started school, there were no other deaf children in her year. What did she do? She taught the hearing kids to sign, and some of them are still her best friends. Felix was desperate for the grandkids to have implants. Miriam said, Any time we get together with the family, that's all we talk about. Felix had offered his grandchildren $1 million each to have the procedure. He said to me, I should do it the other way. If they don't have the implants, I will take $1 million each and give it away. He made a show of lowering his voice and whispered extremely loudly, The truth is, she doesn't want me to be happy. Miriam turned to me. I didn't hope for deaf children, she said. I didn't expect them. Now that I have deaf kids, I am very happy because they are a part of the world that I'm in and they understand where I'm coming from. If I had hearing kids, however, my family would like me more. Then they both started to laugh. Felix said, Well, that's our story. I think your book should be called Father Knows Best. It will be some time before implanted people can savor the nuance of a Verdi opera or discern the voice of a singing turtle dove in a forest full of crows. But implant developers are closing in on enabling the perception of sufficient auditory information for the consistent development of verbal fluency. The objections left standing are conceptual. As Felix Feldman bitterly noted, many deaf activists contend that cochlear implants are part of a genocidal attempt to destroy and eliminate the deaf community. Some have compared pediatric implantation to intrusive surgeries, such as those used to correct intersex conditions, which many intersex adults have protested. The British deaf activist Patty Ladd refers to implants as the final solution. And Patrick Boudreau speaks of a cultural and linguistic extermination campaign. Northeastern's Harlan Lane wrote, Could you imagine if somebody stood up and said, in a few years, we're going to be able to eliminate black culture? He sees the implant as representing just such an assault. If hearing people saw the deaf community as an ethnic group with its own language, as opposed to someone who is handicapped, then you wouldn't have such a deep misunderstanding. Is the underlying hearing person being liberated by the implant, or is the authentic deaf person being obliterated? Hearing specialists and medical clinics have, unfortunately, tended to give little support to campaigns to ensure that parents meet deaf people before implanting their deaf children. Many physicians do not provide parents with deaf community contacts, and few parents seek out the contacts that are provided to them. Only Sweden has a law that requires such parents to meet with representatives of the deaf community and learn about their lives before making this major medical decision for their child. The question, really, is how we define the relationship between parents and children. 100 years ago, children were effectively property, and you could do almost anything to them short of killing them. Now, children are empowered. But parents still decide, what their children should wear, what they should eat, when they should sleep, and so on. Are decisions about bodily integrity also properly the province of parents? Some opponents of implants have proposed that people make their own choice when they turn 18. Even putting aside the neural issues that make this impractical, it is a flawed proposition. At 18, you are choosing not simply between being deaf and being hearing, but between the culture you have known and the life you have not. By then, your experience of the world has been defined by being deaf, and to give it up is to reject whom you have become. Children with implants have experienced social difficulties. If the objective of the implants is to make the children feel good about themselves, the results are mixed. Some become what William Evans of the University of California has called culturally homeless, neither hearing nor deaf. The population at large does not like threats to binaries. Binaries drive homophobia and racism and xenophobia, the constant impulse to define an us and a them. The wall between hearing and deaf is being broken down by a broad range of technology. Hearing aids and implants that create what some activists call the cyborg mix, bodies that are physically enhanced in some way. Though some implanted adolescents disconnect them in their teen years, most perceive them as extremely useful. In one study from 2002, 2/3 of parents reported that their children had never refused to use the implant. There is presumably more adolescent resistance to, for example, seat belts. Barbara Matuski told her husband, Ralph Kamenga, that she would have children if he insisted, and he insisted. She was still working, driving a forklift in a warehouse for Procter & Gamble in West Virginia, when she was 9 months pregnant with her son, Nicholas. It was 1987, and she'd never even heard the word audiology. When Nicholas was 6 months old, she decided to see a specialist. She thought maybe the baby was having ear infections. She had to wait 3 months for an appointment. The specialist sent the family to Johns Hopkins for further assessment and another 3 month wait. When she finally got the diagnosis, Barbara was offended by everyone's expectation that she would be in despair. But she said to me, "When you asked to do this interview, I said, if you're looking for somebody who was devastated by this, don't come here, because I don't have that story. But I can tell you now that I didn't sleep, and I cried a lot at night. I would lay in bed and say, if he is deaf and he wants to play football, what? I did this with everything in his future life. Everything." Barbara and Ralph first chose an oral education for Nick. "I ended up with a teacher who would talk to me about the fabulous therapy she'd done and how successful her kids are," Barbara said. "Every day I would think, today she is going to unleash the wonder." It never happened. Nick loved garbage trucks, so Barbara would take him out and follow a garbage truck for hours, trying to teach him words to go with what they were watching, hoping that if the words referred to things that interested him, the words themselves would interest him. Being oral was horrible. Everything was about them saying words. It was so intense, so totally unnatural. I was a maniac. Ralph wanted to look at a cochlear implant, at that time still a new technology, and Barbara refused. "That was not a decision I could make, to cut my kid's head open. You're trying to make a decision for this future adult, but what you've got is a baby. It's about who they are as people, and you don't know that when they're infants." Barbara saw that Nick was too isolated, so she decided to have another child, a hearing sibling who could help translate for him. The day she gave birth, Barbara told the hospital about the protocols for testing hearing in newborns. Brittany, they declared, was hearing. She is in her crib, crying in her room, and I'm playing with Nick, and I can remember hollering, "Brittany, you're okay. You can hear me. Nick needs me." I didn't know that what I really wanted was another deaf kid. Once I realized she wasn't hearing, which was within the first 2 months, I called the audiologist and said, "Order me hearing aids." I called the school and said, "She's deaf. She needs to be in a class." So at 3 months, she's aided, she's seeing sign, a whole different situation. When two teachers were assigned to come to the house and work on Barbara's signing and Brittany's language exposure, however, Barbara found their presence oppressive. "I kept saying, 'My kids are right where they need to be,'" she recalled. "So they would say to me, 'Think how much smarter they would be if you had started earlier.' They were right, and I didn't want to hear it." Brittany produced a broad range of phonemes and was identified as a good candidate for oral education, which Nick was already receiving. Nick, on the other hand, couldn't make a comprehensible speech sound. I could just see that it wasn't going to work for him. So then it was like, do I sacrifice him for her, or her for him? Because we can't be oral and sign. So I decided we're going to start signing. They lived 2 hours away from the residential Maryland School for the Deaf, and she enrolled both children there. The school was then doing a version of bye-bye, but the school day took place in sign. Barbara enrolled in an ASL interpreter training program near the school. Ralph had to settle for an ASL class at a local high school, but she couldn't bear to have them bored. From not wanting kids, I fell in love with my kids, so she drove them both ways every day. The deaf educators resisted the arrangement, but Barbara was adamant. "That part of it I hated. Deaf of deaf are golden, and deaf of hearing are subservient and not so great. My kids really felt the negative weight of all that. I questioned the deaf community every step of the way. I might have said, 'Here, take my kids. Let them live in the dorm. Have at it. You are the experts.' Would my kids have been any further along developmentally? I can tell you, those kids who effectively lose their parents are much further behind." Once she'd done her interpreter's training, Barbara took a volunteer position at the school. Eventually, she got a job there as a secretary. Barbara struggled to give her children a feeling of confidence. "The whole time they were growing up, I said, 'You can do anything you want to do. This doesn't limit you.' Then it started to hit me. It's got nothing to do with them. It's got to do with that hearing person across from them at an interview." In the end, Barbara became a champion of deaf culture. "I didn't embrace it for a long time," she said. "Now I meet parents and I say, 'Look, learning ASL is the hardest thing you will ever do in your life. You will never be good enough. You will still not understand your kid, and you will still not always be able to communicate what you want to say. That's the truth, and it's not easy." When I met her, Barbara had become the head of family services for the deaf at a local university. Nick and Brittany are much less interested in deaf activism than she is. Nick had announced that the best thing he could do for deaf people was to go out into the world and work and become himself. This is just fine with Barbara, who worked hard to give her children that confidence. "The deaf community fills them up with pride, and then they don't want to let them go," Barbara complained. "A kid will be raised in a deaf school, he will go to Gallaudet, then he will come back to the deaf school and teach. So their knowledge of the world is this. They bring nothing new and nothing diverse." Barbara got her kids enrolled at Northridge instead, where there is a strong deaf studies program and a large deaf population. Both children have made strong showings in written English. While Nick makes little use of vocal language, Brittany decided in college that she was going back to speech therapy and has been thinking about getting an implant. She wants to work in film production, and she wants to be comfortable in the hearing world. She wants to make it as easy for hearing people as she can, Barbara said. Brittany has a lot of speech. The problem is, she is embarrassed to use it. She has an interpreter at college who said to her, "You shouldn't talk, because deaf people sound horrible when they talk." So she's sending my husband emails saying, "Does my voice sound horrible?" This is an interpreter, her lifeline to communication. If I saw this woman, I would probably choke her. Brittany has been concerned about how her deaf friends would react to her getting an implant. "So what does she do?" Barbara said. "Does she give up her dreams and settle? Or does she get this implant if it will make it easier to get her dream job? They're deaf in a hearing world. That's the reality." Barbara worries about her children in that world, but she has no regrets. "If my kids were hearing, my daughter and I would not have gotten along," she said. "We are two strong personalities. My son would have gotten into so much trouble. If I'd had hearing kids, I would have worked, and they would have gone to childcare. Having deaf kids made me a much better mother. I like fighting for the cause. I like empowering people. We get along really great, the bunch of us. We really do. I hope they have deaf children. I want them to have kids who are just like them." Deaf people in the hearing world are always going to be at a disadvantage. So the question is whether people prefer to be marginal in a mainstream world or mainstream in a marginal world. And many people quite understandably prefer the latter. At the same time, those who oppose cochlear implants, and who in some cases oppose hearing aids and other technologies, are a noisy bunch, which has often led people to universalize from their views. In fact, these views can be constraining. There seems to be subtle pressure from some deaf people to give up hearing aids, sort of a deaf liberation equivalent to bra burning, wrote Catherine Woodcock, a Canadian deaf woman. There is prejudice in the deaf community against any form of listening. "At this point in my progressive hearing loss, I can usually still hear a firm, multiple knock on the door of a quiet room. This has earned me suspicious glances and even overt queries as to why I am present in a deaf group. This is absurd." The commentator Irene Lee has written, "While I perceive myself as sufficiently competent in deaf ways and as capable of participating within deaf culture, I can also communicate adequately with users of spoken English. Because of this, I have at times been labeled as hearing mind, not truly deaf." Josh Swiller, a deaf man raised in the hearing world and educated orally, came to deaf identity late, and has written about it beautifully. He used hearing aids and other devices. "Basically, with aids, you're constantly translating every line of language into itself. Like the high school sophomore at the college bar with a great fake ID, I could fool everyone into believing I was who I pretended to be. It gnawed at me that this way of navigating the world was based on a fundamentally untenable position. A two-sided lie. To others, I can hear you. To myself, it doesn't matter how much I miss or how alone I feel, as long as others think I can hear. It drove me crazy. I kept doing it. It was all I knew." Swiller made his way to Gallaudet. Soon after he arrived, a school newspaper poll asked whether students would take a pill that would give them hearing instantly. And the majority answered that they would not, because they were proud of who they were. Swiller wrote, "But who are we? I wanted to know. Who looks out from our eyes?" Years later, he posted a short biography of himself on his website with this description. "In 2005, Josh had surgery for a cochlear implant. The implant has been a remarkable success." He also, with great pride, uses American Sign Language. He rejects the defensiveness and distrust that divides the deaf community and believes that our similarity should and will overcome our divisions. While the debate rages over cochlear implants, implantable hearing aids and other assistive devices for hearing loss continue to be refined and developed. In parallel, research into biological non-prosthetic cures for deafness has blossomed. There are many kinds of hearing loss, but most come from the loss of the auditory hair cells in the cochlea. These cells, which receive sound in a form in which it can be conveyed along nerve pathways to the brain, are produced in the first 3 months of the fetal period and are incapable of regenerating, or so conventional wisdom long assumed. In the early 1980s, however, Jeffrey T. Corwin, now at the University of Virginia, noticed that adult sharks have a greater number of receptive hair cells than baby sharks, and subsequent research demonstrated that fish and amphibians produce hair cells throughout life to replace those that have been lost. A few years later, Douglas Cotanche, director of the Laboratory of Cellular and Molecular Hearing Research at Boston University, discovered that baby chicks whose hair cells were completely destroyed by autotoxic poisoning or sound trauma regenerated hair cells. Tests confirmed that these chicks had recovered hearing. These discoveries led researchers to investigate whether such processes could be achieved in human beings. In 1992, researchers in Corwin's lab fed retinoic acid to embryonic mice. The mice were born with 6 or 9 rows of hair cells, rather than the usual 3. Building on this work, in 1993, a group working at Albert Einstein Medical Center published an article in Science in which they described their success at causing the regrowth of hair cells by treating the damaged inner ear of an adolescent rat with a mixture of retinoic acid and calf serum. Since most deafness is degenerative, even those born deaf have usually lost auditory hair cells in utero, the question remained whether the new hair cells would survive in the inner ear, or whether they would die off again as their predecessor cells had done. Henrik Staker, a professor of otolaryngology at the University of Kansas, is now trying to determine what is necessary for the neuritic stem to grasp onto a hair cell, the process through which the response of the cochlea is transmitted to the brain. In the late 1990s, burgeoning insight into stem cells inspired inquiry into how they might be made to differentiate into auditory hair cells and then be introduced into the inner ear. In 2003, Stefan Heller and his colleagues successfully cultivated auditory hair cells from mouse stem cells. 6 years later, a team at the University of Sheffield demonstrated that human fetal auditory stem cells could be cultivated in vitro, and that they would develop into either functional auditory neurons or hair cells. Treating the cells with retinoic acid helped this occur. Genetic research into deafness, which has so angered the deaf community because of its relevance to selective abortion, is not primarily focused on pregnancy termination. Scientists are hoping to develop gene therapies to promote the growth of auditory hair cells, both in utero and postnatally. With the identification of the ATOH1 gene as essential to the development of auditory hair cells, researchers have focused on developing therapies to introduce and induce the expression of ATOH1 in animals, and to inhibit processes that damage existing cells, including oxidative stress, which appears to be a major contributor to age-related hearing loss. Other currently targeted genes control the function of the transduction channel that conveys messages from the auditory hair cells to the brain. Technologies now in the works include the implantation of electrodes that stimulate hearing nerve fibers, the miniaturization of implant technology, fully implantable cochlear devices, and implantable hearing aids. In the early 1960s, A rubella epidemic in the United States resulted in a high incidence of deaf children